It's now 12 o'clock, and this is WFMT Chicago, 98.7 FM, a service of Network Chicago. And we hope you'll stay with us now as we bring you Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a new monthly series presenting interviews with authors before a live audience. It's a unique collaborative effort of Chicago Magazine, WFMT, and Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks. Victoria Lautman's guest today is Bosnian-American author, Chicago denizen, and newly minted MacArthur Fellow, Alexander Heyman, author of the novel Nowhere Man. His collection of stories, The Question of Bruno, published in 2000, was called astonishing, brilliant, and utterly unique by reviewers from the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle. Both books reveal Heyman's impressive gift for creative narration and minute observation.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you for coming to Writers on the Record. I'm Victoria Lautman, your host and producer of this monthly author interview series, which is co-sponsored by Chicago Magazine and 98.7 WFMT Radio. We're here with our other collaborator, Looking Glass Theater, on the set of what is going to be Looking Glass Alice, a program that is opening up. It's actually going to be in preview starting February 2nd, a very physical, very enjoyable, very unusual performance. This is a series that brings authors here once a month. You can listen in. You can come to free to the events for free, as you have. And we do sell the books in the lobby at the end of the program. There will also be questions taken from the audience. Start thinking of them now. And I would like to just introduce our author here today, Alexander Heyman, now to be known as Sasha for the rest of this production. But I have to say that you have to imagine for a moment what would have happened if the fates had not intervened in Sasha Heyman's life the way that they did, if you know anything about what's come to be the mythology surrounding him and his success as a writer in this country. What if, when Sasha Heyman was touring the United States on a government-sponsored cultural kind of wingding in 1992, what if he had ended up in Bangor, Maine, or Reno on May 1st, watching television as his hometown of Sarajevo was about to be besieged? He had a ticket to leave that day, and he ended up here in Chicago, where he decided to stay, not Reno, not Bangor, not Butte, Montana. So we got kind of lucky. I think he got kind of lucky, too. He then began a course of study on his own, learning the English language, which at that point he'd only had a tourist's acquaintance with, and 3 years later began working on the first story that became one of the stories in his book, The Question of Bruno, published in 2000 to great acclaim. 2 years later, he wrote Nowhere Man. 2 years after that, just last year in 2004, you have all these like even numbers in your life, he got the MacArthur Prize. It's been an incredible story of his own life and as the life of a new and fascinating literary figure. It's a pleasure to welcome Sasha Heyman. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I kind of like you to start where I left off. I know it's sort of a constructed history. You had an entire history of your life before you arrived in Chicago. But the decision at that point to not just stay here, but to continue a career as a writer, which you'd already started before that in Sarajevo, you decided to write in English. You had to learn the language well enough to write. And the first story you began to write, something which you said was born out of despair, was the story about a spy.
Yes, the Zorge Spying. This was in 95, I believe. Despair, I had planned to, I gave myself 5 years to write a first publishable story in English, which would have been in 97. And so I, in order to learn the language well enough, I read, as you have said, but I also enrolled in a graduate program at Northwestern. And for reasons I can't quite remember, I was certain that after I acquired my master's degree that I would be admitted to the PhD program. It never crossed my mind, it was a bit of a delusion there, that I would not be admitted. And, of course, I wasn't admitted. And so suddenly I found myself with nothing to do, long stretches of future, hopeless future, I should say. And I had already been reading books. I had already known quite a bit about Zorge, the spy, Richard Zorge, and have been reading books on him, collecting data and facts and notes for at least a year prior to the writing of the story. But once I realized that there was no academic future ahead of me, which I'm, of course, happy about now, I realized that I had, you know, no choice but to sit down and write the damn story. Can I say this on the radio?
That's not one of the seven words.
This was close. So I had to sit down and write it. I had no idea if I could do it, quite literally.
For what reason? Because of the language?
Because I hadn't written a story in English. I wrote a note to a story that I had translated from my native language prior to that, which was published in Tragic Quarterly, the Northwestern literary magazine. So I knew I could write something in English, and, you know, I knew that I could write in general, but I was not sure that I could write a whole story, particularly a story as ambitious as the Zorge Spiring, which is one of my longest stories, I have to say. So I sat down and just started writing the story and wrote it, surprising myself quite often with the words that I was using because I didn't quite know I knew them. I had to look up the words that I was using in my own story. And then they would be right, which is, it was as if I had been possessed by some sort of language demon.
Well, part of this whole myth that I keep reading in the endless articles that have been written about you is that in order to help you learn the language, you took a copy of Lolita from Nabokov, one of your favorite heroes, author, and circled all the words that you didn't understand and then sort of obsessively wrote these words down, captured them on index cards. Is that true, or is this just something that...
It is true, except it wasn't just Lolita. Nobody reads just one book, well, except for the president. Nobody, I mean, a writer doesn't read one book. And, you know, if you're interested in literature, particularly if you're learning a language that you want to use for writing, you read a lot of books. I read compulsively, and I read Lolita, which I love and still love, and read many other books, books that I had read in translation in my native language, Bosnian, but also books that I hadn't read. And initially I started underlining them, but then they were destroying the books because there was so much underlining. So I started making notes on note cards, and making long lists of words that I would look up afterwards. And I had thousands of those note cards.
I think before we go further, I would actually like you to read a short section from the Zorge Spiring. And he's only really reading a truncated part of it because it's in two parts. There's the part he's going to read, which is, as you'll hear, the kind of memories of a 10-year-old boy. And then there's a lot of footnotes that go along with it. Do you want to comment on that first or afterwards?
There's an upper story. There's a lower story. It's a two-tier story. The footnotes cover the life of Richard Zorge, the famous spy, the historical character who was spying for the Soviet Union in Japan during World War II and before that elsewhere. He was the one who informed Stalin that Japan would expand southwards, that is, they would not attack across the border in Siberia, but rather southward, Pearl Harbor and, you know, the Pacific basin. Consequently, Stalin withdrew about 3 million Soviet soldiers and transferred them to the Western Front, to the Soviet Western Front, to stop the German advance. And the meaning of this is that Zorge's work directly influenced the outcome of World War II. The book was auburn with black slanted letters on the spine reading Spies of World War II, and impressed onto the front cover, black letters, tiny trenches with golden brims reading The Greatest Spies of World War II. The book was big and weighty. I'd put it on my knees, but then its weight would spread my legs and the book would close itself and slip to the floor. And I'd lie on my belly and rest my head on the scaffold on my hands and read. When my elbows would begin to ache, I'd recline my cheek on the thicker half of the book, incline the other half, feeling the sticky moisture connecting my cheek and a spy's face, secrets of World War II just inches away from my absorbing pupils. There were lots of black and white pictures, a five-man column surrounded by soldiers pointing rifles with their hands on the napes of their necks. When I narrowed my eyes, they looked like black and white butterflies. The head of a chubby member of the Rote Kapelle with an asymmetrical face, nose slightly on the left side, right eye hardly opened and seemingly asleep, mouth kept shut with effort as if there was a spring of blood behind the feeble lips. I just knew from his face that his hands, swollen wrists, bloody burning trenches under the cuffs, were handcuffed. A picture of General Montgomery standing, arms akimbo, turned sideways, looking at the upper corner of the page with a timeless beret parallel with his gaze. General Montgomery's doppelganger just ahead, looking at me with odd pensiveness, as if painfully aware that he could never be General Montgomery. A row of blindfolded people in white in front of the ready firing squad, and a smiling officer, his right arm raised, pointing at the upper right corner of the picture. And near the end, there was Zorge, at the outset of his mission in Japan, framed by a door behind his back, standing legs apart in a dark trench coat, one hand pocketed, the other somewhat clenched, holding a purse or a camera case. And his head, fiendish ears, large and ill-shaped, lips shut tight as if his teeth were biting the inside of his lower lip. The wide base triangle of his nose, its top angle connected by two deep furrows with two dark dots in the corners of his mouth. Lightless twin holes at the bottom of which were his eyes and the black ink helmet of hair. The picture was obviously retouched. Zorge's anxiety was burdened with someone else's curtained body. One could see the sharp cut at the verge of his collar, where his head, guillotined in a shadowy laboratory, was attached to a headless trench coat, plus an inexplicable excess of neck flesh on the left side. But I believed that Zorge was in that trench coat. I believed that he was about to enter the door apparition behind his back. I believed in the totality of that picture. I believed in the apparent, and I trusted books. I was 10.
Thank you. From the story, The Sword Gate Spy Ring, in The Question of Bruno, which was published in 2000. There are 8 stories in that book, and they're all so different from one another, yet alike in ways. And the idea that you have been accessing the memory of a 10-year-old, the first story, Islands, is also a memory of a childhood. There are perspectives, parallel lives written through letters. You use the voice of a woman in one of them and a man in the United States. There are a lot of parallel lives that take place in these works. And there's a story that when your agent took this book around to sell it, that people actually didn't believe that you existed. They thought that because this was written from so many different points of view and in such an unusual kind of fractured way, that you actually didn't exist. Some people accused her of writing the book.
Well, actually, it happened a couple of times that people that she was talking to, scouts from Europe or something, they did not believe that I existed, which I took as a compliment. Please tell me I don't exist. And I took it as a compliment precisely because of the things that you outlined, that in some ways it is easy to overwhelm your book with your authorial presence. That is, you know, convenient and pleasant, and it might sell a lot of books, and you might briefly be a celebrity in a very, very narrow circle among very few people. But the fact of the matter is that if you are bigger than your book, then your book is not as good as it could be. So I like to disappear in my stories and my books. I like to not quite hide behind them because there's nothing to hide, but put them out in front. I write books because I want to see certain things become objects unto themselves. I want them to be reified, to become something they cannot be in my mind. And so once they're out there, there is this very pleasant feeling of being divorced from those books. They do not belong to me the way they belong to me when I write them. They are not my experience any longer. They're a common experience. That's why you're here, I would hope, so we can somehow share that experience, you know, approaching from different directions perhaps, but still, we share this experience of my book.
The idea that you put these stories together, and some of the characters that appear in The Question of Bruno make a reappearance in your later book, Nowhere Man, a novel, and even though that is not quite as disparate in terms of the types of, like, the history involved and rocketing through time or showing the so many of the different voices that you did in The Question of Bruno. There's still this this style that I think of yours is so unique, which is to, in a way, try and show every perspective of something that's going on. It's nonlinear. People have talked about it as being almost like a cubist painting. Some people, I think, some of your reviewers have been very confused by that, have tried to ascribe particular meanings to the fact that you've written like this and equating it with the chaos of life. I wonder what you say to people. I mean, is this the way history needs to be approached now in a chaotic time?
Well, this is a basic fact of human life. It's very complicated. I mean, we all know this. And history is an accumulation of an infinite number of human lives. It's the totality of human experience. And literature, perhaps, is an abbreviated version of that human experience, condensed, if you wish, rather than abbreviated. So to express that experience, one, or at least I, have to create a sort of a network of meanings. This network has a blueprint, as it were, and this network is language. This is how language operates. We are all entangled in language. Our experiences are shared in this common field of language. I have come from a different country, speak with a different accent, use words weirdly. Nevertheless, we speak across this language. And not only that, there are sort of physical and emotional relations that one has with words and the language. And this is what literature taps into. This is what's so beautiful about writing and reading, that somehow if you read a book from 19th century in translation, say Madame Bovary, that somehow you recognize this as your own experience. This is the miracle of literature. For this to happen, in a sense, I have to enter this field of language and not to try to control it, to order it in a linear manner, to organize it into some sort of fallacious plot that would just end up with a happily united family or whatever. So this is, of course, what I have explained to myself after I have written a lot of the stuff that I have written, because I simply cannot write a linear story. I mean, I have tried. but I write like books that I enter as if entering a country, or city, rather. I like that. You enter a city and then you walk around and you look this way, that way. You know what these buildings are for. You know the streets that you might be on, but some streets are completely obscure and there are whole sections of the city that you have no access to, but you know stories about them. And to enter a book the way you enter a city, it's an adventure in language as such. The model for this, for me, is really Ulysses, Joyce's Ulysses, where the city of Dublin is inscribed in language in that book to the most minute details, including the height of the fence on the Eccles Street that Bloom has to jump over and so on. To me, that's an exciting situation while writing, but also while reading.
You know, this sounds so serious. I was just thinking, listening to this, if somebody had not read any of your books, they wouldn't realize that they're actually, they're very, very funny. I mean, they're laugh out loud, kind of mordant humor. I mean, you're kind of laughing and sort of not exactly crying, but grimacing in a lot of places. And yet, I think in listening to you, people might get the wrong idea and think, well, yes, these are incredibly literary books. The language is amazing. I mean, there's words that I actually meant to look up, and are all the words real? Is mizzle a word?
Yes, it is.
There are a lot of words that, you know, it's just startling that you, coming here, learning the language in 3 years, are putting words into your stories that I grew up here, speak English, I've never even heard of, and yet what isn't coming across here is that there is a real humor factor in them, and I think it's really an important component to your work.
It is very important. Nevertheless, I don't, the books, I didn't put in the humor so as to be entertaining, to cover up for the seriousness or to, alter the seriousness. So here's the serious stuff, but then there are, there's a comic relief. Here's a commercial. It doesn't work that way. It is the same thing. Nabokov famously said about Chekhov that Chekhov wrote sad stories for humorous people. And he said that in order to see the sadness of Chekhov's stories, you had to have a sense of humor. And I would, you know, say that's the case in Chekhov's case, that to see their humor, you have to have some sort of this sadness that a lot of human lives are full of. Not that I compare myself to Chekhov, but I recognize this sensibility, and I would recognize the sensibility as a sort of an Eastern European Slavic sensibility, not necessarily Slavic, Eastern European sensibility, where you cannot take your life seriously for a number of reasons, partly because, you know, there's a war every once in a while or a dictator. So you have to approach the life, your own life and the world with a certain skeptic attitude.
Well, one of the characters who I think is in both of your books, the character of Josef Pronek, who is first makes an appearance in The Question of Bruno and in one of the longest stories there. And by the way, there's a story in The Question of Bruno, the accordion, that's literally 4 pages long and rockets through several hundred years of history. And yet we could also go to a story like Josef Pronek and the dead, blind Josef Pronek and the Dead Souls, which is, I think, 75 pages long. Really, it's like a novella. This character reappears in Nowhere Man, and this guy, his life as your sort of doppelganger, in a way, it's like an alter ego. People think of him as you. I know that you've denied that, and you've said that some of his experiences in this country have echoed yours. I mean, you were a bicycle messenger. You were a car parker. I think you did work in... Did you work in the Boudin Bakery like Pronek did? You worked at some restaurant?
Yeah, I did, but I was never a car parker.
Oh, excuse me.
You wouldn't want to give your car to me.
This character has just, I think, entered so many people's minds. He's like, you know, we watch him sort of trying to get his footing in this country as an immigrant. First, we meet him as, you know, kind of a... We grow up with him, see his childhood, which was a beautiful childhood, a middle-class childhood in Sarajevo, and watch him as he enters adolescence and falls in love. And he's this kind of like sexy, confident, curious guy who then ends up in America, as so many immigrants do, not speaking the language, being treated really badly, confused, shaky. It's very hard to reconcile these characters, like who he was before and who he is here. You've talked yourself about the gap between trying to make yourself understood, the thoughts that you had in your mind, and trying to communicate them, and even taught, I think, English as a second language to other people who are trying to bridge that gap too. It seems to me to be at the core of so much of your work, trying to make yourself understood.
That's part of it, but what you were talking about is the situation in which Pronek's life, my life at some point or another, also a lot of people's lives, not only immigrant but refugees. There's a certain difference between immigrants and refugees. A lot of Bosnians, most of Bosnians are in fact refugees. But however you define those lives of people who come here, there is a moment in which those lives become discontinuous. There's a moment of leaving wherever they come from and coming here. You know, that moment might be more or less traumatic, but it's to a large extent traumatic. Who you used to be, you are no longer. Now, you know, famously, people talk about the self-invention in America, but even if that works out as simply as the mythology would have it, you have to abandon who you were. You have to forget who you were and what constituted you. If this is caused by some sort of violence, as it's been the case for Bosnians, then the trauma is amplified. It's not only that you stop being who you used to be, but you did not do it of your own volition. And this is what people are dealing with, you know, I mean, in therapy often. This is interesting to me because, and it's hard to say which came first, because of my inclination and an interest in discontinuous narratives. Here's a fundamental discontinuous narrative. In a fiction that comes or is created in relatively stable countries, at least in countries where people can imagine and live their lives as continuous, you know, it's so easy to write and read a novel in which the character enters the novel at the beginning and then there's some sort of development, an arc, there might be a crisis of some sort, but it's one continuous narrative. You start at the point A, you end at the point B, And at the end, you know, you're happy or unhappy, but it's one straight line. For people like me, or people similar to me, or people I'm similar to, the continuous line is one big lie. It's very hard to imagine a life like that. And this goes in hand with the serious stuff that I was talking about earlier, that history is not a continuous line, that nobody's life really is a continuous line. We make up a story of our life so it looks like a continuous line. But if you look at back at your life, you know, there are many, so many forking paths, as it were. There were so many confused moments where things just happened out of your control. There are so many memories that memories never operate as linear straight stories. If you try to remember a day from your life, you're not going to remember the morning first and then the afternoon and then the evening and then going to sleep. It's going to be a jumble of moments that you might or might not try to assemble into some sort of linear narrative. So the trauma that I have been acquainted with, that trauma discontinuity, is related or has become related to this formal interest of, you know, in discontinuous narratives.
You know, I think this is probably a good time for a break, because when we come back, you're going to actually do two readings, one which is going to be from Nowhere Man and one from a work in progress from which nobody's heard any of what he's going to be reading. This is going to be the first world premiere of an Alexander Heyman part of his story. When we come back, you're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, and we'll be back in just about a minute.
You're listening to Writers on the Record here over WFMT 98.7 FM, Chicago's Classical Experience. This program focusing on noteworthy authors who have published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. In the icy chill of winter, find comfort and warmth in a perfect cup of tea. An ancient tradition in Japan, tea has been elevated to an art form. At Aiko's Art Materials, you'll find the ideal vessel for brewing your tea, along with just the right teacup. Special iron and earthenware teapots and teacups available in sets or individually are sure to enhance the experience. Warm both body and spirit as you discover the essence of tea at Aiko's. Aiko's Art Materials, for beautiful Japanese paper and gift items to inspire and delight, at 3347 North Clark Street in Chicago. Phone 773-404-5600. From Stock to Schulte, Barenboim, and beyond, tune in 98.7 for our Chicago Symphony Retrospective each Sunday at 1 on WFMT. Join Don Tate as he samples the CSO's rich recorded history on Chicago Symphony Retrospective, Sunday afternoons at 1. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A in Chicago Magazine, accompanied by announcements in the magazine, and on 98.7 WFMT for the interviews, which take place Sundays at noon once a month at Looking Glass Theater. And if you'd like to be in the audience for the next broadcast on February 20th with Mark Kurlansky, admission is free. Reservations may be made at 312-832-6789.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome back to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a collaboration between Chicago Magazine and 98.7 WFMT Radio here at the Looking Glass Theater. I want to remind everybody that coming up once a month, this is free. You can come to it. You can listen to it. But we have really great authors coming up in this season. The next one, February 20th, is Mark Kurlansky, the best-selling author of Cod, the Fish That Changed the World, and Salt. But he went on to write the biography of a year called 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. It's going to be coming out in paperback, and we'll be talking to him here on February 20th. Later on, we'll be having Francine Prose, Jonathan Safran Foer with his new book, Sue Miller, Michael Cunningham. All of these authors are going to be here as part of Writers on the Record, talking about their new work. It's very exciting, and I hope you'll all call for a reservation. Get those questions ready, because in just about 20, 25 minutes, we're going to force you to come down to the microphone to talk or ask a question of Alexander Heyman, Sasha Heyman, who, of course, just won the 2004 MacArthur Prize. We like to call him a genius, although that's not what they say the prize is, but we all know it really is about genius.
It's and a fellowship. I'm a fellow.
You're a fellow. You are a fellow. You're a genius fellow. a modest genius fellow. His novel Nowhere Man was published in 2002. His book The Question of Bruno, short stories, was published in the year 2000. Before you actually read a little bit of Nowhere Man, can you say a little bit more about this character of Josef Pronek, who you deny is you, but has had some of your experiences? I know you're ready to read it there, but before you do that, I think that people really want to equate all the stories that you tell in both books with Sasha Heyman specifically.
Well, that's the usual reflex, you know, seeing the author in the books. But I'm every character in my book. If I'm anybody, I'm every character in my book, not just one of them. So I'm either nobody in my book or everybody in my book. Josef Pronek's life is parallel to mine. I've done this deliberately. I mean, organized his life so it is parallel to my life. But it's also parallel in a sense that if you grew up at a certain time in Sarajevo and were of a certain age in Sarajevo at a certain time, then your lives would have overlapped to a significant amount. It's a relatively small town. You know, everybody knows everybody in the end. People don't really move in and out the way they come in and out of a big American city. So a lot of the things that happened to him happened to me, but also happened to a large number of young people at that age. I like to fall back on my experiences simply because I am short on imagination and long on memories. And so I involve those things. But people will read this and, you know, they should not be punished for that. They'll read Josef Pronek as me, but I don't see him as me. He's not, when I read my writing on Pronek, I don't remember myself. I see this young man who I feel fond of in so many ways, but I don't see myself.
This is a book which talks about the character of Pronek, who is observed by first a narrator whom we never even learn the name of, but seems to shadow Pronek around throughout his life, even in very intimate situations where he's kind of spying on the guy. It's never explained to us who this anonymous narrator is. Another narrator comes into it, is in the Ukraine where Pronek goes. This is a man that falls in love with him. We do know his name, Victor, but again, it's as though you think of characters in these books as spies, like Sergei, people who are being observed, people who are to a certain extent invisible or not maybe aware of being observed, maybe altering their lives because of it. And I think it's probably no surprise that at the end of Nowhere Man, there's a chapter that's really mystified a lot of people who've read the book and your critics who are trying to figure out, now why did he put that in? Here's this narrator's reappearing in Shanghai, and it's covering 100 years of history and refers to another spy. I don't know, everybody's going to have their own metaphors and associations, but so many of your characters really do seem worried that they are going to be forgotten, that they are going to become invisible, that they can't speak and be heard. Very much the way I think spies are forced to create, as you say, a legend of their own life, never being allowed to be who they truly are.
Well, there are two aspects of this. One of them, the spies' stories are fun and interesting, and, you know, I've read them as a kid, and I still read them. I like John le Carré quite a bit. But there's the situation which spies project their outward personality, as it were, which is completely made up and includes a made-up past, a legend, and spy terminology, the life that a spy invents for himself or herself so as to acquire different identities, called a legend. They acquire an outward personality that has nothing to do with what they have inside, and this gap between the outward and the inward, as it were, is controlled. So it is a fantasy that I have and have had, because to a lot of us, and you know, in my case, I cannot control this in so many ways, particularly in the situation of immigration, where you can't quite explain who you are because you can't quite explain who you used to be. So this gap between who you would like to be and who you are, or who you're trying to be and who you are, and who you're not trying to be and who you are, this is what interests me as a writer. This is the gap that opens up a lot of possibility in literature, and this is the gap that as a reader, interests a lot of people. That is the gap between what you imagine the character is and what the character might really be. We always imagine that we know the character, but then we also know that we don't quite know the character. This desire to completely possess the character on the part of the reader is very interesting, but it's also very realistic, and this is where those two things link. That, you know, I've taught creative writing workshops, and the most common sentence in discussing someone else's work, the most common sentence that the students use, they say, "I want to know more about this character." And they say this for a number of reasons, but this desire to know more, right, it's practically endless. Of course, you can only know everything about yourself, and even that is, you know, questionable. But of other people, your knowledge can only be limited. But this desire to know of other people, on the one hand, it's voyeuristic, it's titillating. On the other hand, it's part of this natural human curiosity. And it's also a consequence of the situation, social situation, which other people are very far away from you, architecturally, culturally, in so many ways, that you simply, in this country, for instance, one of the marks of success is complete isolation. If you're rich and successful, you have, you know, 20-foot walls around your mansion and cameras watching, you know, who's walking by your property. So to want to know what is going on in the lives of the people in the books is at the same time natural and perverse. And this is what interests me and has interested me in these books, because here's Josef Pronek. I've written these books in English for primarily American audience. What are they going to know about them? To have a fixed single narrator would allow people to forget that there's this voyeuristic or aspect and the aspects of curiosity in their reading. So I wanted to unbalance the narrator's position so people can get involved with Josef's life differently. And this was necessary if his experience, the experience of this continuous shattered life, was to be conveyed in any sort of honest manner.
Well, having said that, I think you're about to read a passage from Nowhere Man, and this voyeuristic thing you're talking about and the descriptions that you use are so pungent, and I think this passage will show people that.
Yes, Pronek is just coming back home from work. In my books, people work. When he unlocked the door of his studio, everything was in its place. The coffee mug that said, "Kiss me, I'm Irish," he had whimsically bought in a thrift shop, still on the verge on the table. The map of the world still taped to the wall. The clock shaped like a pumpkin, which someone had left in the laundry room, still ticking. A pair of brown shoes turning away from each other in disgust. The wash plate in the rack leaning over the sink as if wanting to see its own reflection. Everything was precisely as he had left it. The amazing thing was, he thought, that when he wasn't there, nobody was there. The space he occupied was empty when he was elsewhere. But the smell was different. He could sense a pungent plastic scent, wholly unfamiliar to him. He moved, sniffing, stepping carefully on the tips of his toes, not turning on the light, ready for an attack, like a wolf returning to his violated den, his body tense and cocked, his eyes scorched with fatigue. He pussyfooted into his bedroom, his shirt stretched on the mattress as if playing dead. He went back to the kitchen, touched the bottom of the empty sink, a cockroach slipping into the hole, headlights flickering on the walls. He dropped to his knees and smelled the carpet in the middle of the room and under the radiator, but he couldn't locate the source. He imagined someone sneaking to his place and browsing crassly and impatiently through everything in this little museum of his life. A green toy chopper he had stolen from someone's porch. A tin wind-up frog. A frame with a picture of his parents raising glasses drunk. A puny wooden bowl full of marbles. A piece of wooden board with nails in it resembling the outline of the Great Bear. He imagined the intruder trying on his clothes, buttoning up his shirts. What would the intruder think of him, Pronek wondered, of his life? He moved on to the bathroom where there was a new shower curtain the landlord had put in, exuding a sharp chemical odor, shimmering in the dark. Pronek woke up with a vague, flabby erection and an itchy feeling that his life was happening to someone else. He sat at the table drinking coffee from the Irish mug, watching the people at the Yale stop waiting. A woman reading a book on a bench, a teenage boy twitching his head, following an obscure rhythm. A man with a straw hat and a sallow face bending forward as if the morning were a sack of cement. a teenage girl with a palm of her hair on top of her head and concentric gold chains on her chest. They stood far apart, not looking at one another. The sun glittered on the rails. This moment, Pranik thought, would not be remembered by anybody but him, and one day it would vanish from his memory too.
There it is, that idea of memory again. So interesting. It comes in your books in so many different ways. You've talked, though, also about the influence of poetry when you write. And you actually, I was amazed to read that you have, in certain of your stories, actually counted the beats of a sentence, constructing it as though it were poetry. And I'm wondering, is that something you did earlier? Did that happen in Nowhere Man 2? Was that just a technique? Or do you deny the quote?
I have no knowledge of that. I do that occasionally. It depends on the story. Some stories require this. I did it in Islands because Islands, the story is all about language in so many ways. There's not much happening. But if things are happening, you know, and if there's some sort of action, a car chase, say, then you can't count beats. Not that there's a car chase in my books. Not yet. So poetry is in some ways the ultimate literature in the sense that forces the reader to confront language and its possibilities. To me, this is immensely interesting as a writer. I write fiction. I write prose. So I can't do it in every sentence because then the sentence is... maybe I could do it. Flaubert, you know, it took him a day to write every sentence, or it took him a long time. Joyce, I'm sure, wrote it that way. But I can't do it. Only occasionally I do it. I did it in the story that I'm going to read from today here and there because it is about a poet. But I have this love of poetry and need for poetry and occasionally go on poetry reading binges when I read nothing but poetry.
Tell us about what you're about to read. Reassure me that there's no F words since I haven't read it myself.
What do you mean by the F word?
Or S or A while we're at it. And I don't remember what the other ones are. But when you're in the process of writing something, how does that work? I mean, you're just pouring it out? Do you have an idea ahead of time? Are you writing things in journals? Are you handwriting it out yourself? How are you doing it?
Well, it's all one organic process. There are no stages. There's a common, in my case, and I think in many other cases, because writing is taught in this country in creative writing workshops, for the sake of teaching, it is broken into stages and phases, which is completely wrong. And in some ways, it's the wrong way to teach the students to write this way, because that's what I do. I mean, my life is organized about what I write. I think about it all the time, even when I don't write, even if when I'm not even thinking consciously of the story that I'm going to write, something is happening. And so the process involves, if I were to break it down in stages, it involves a lot of thinking about the story before I even put down a word on the paper, sometimes years. Then I write it in longhand. It's a very, very rough draft, very messy. And then I type what I've written in longhand, and sometimes I don't even look what I have written because the writing in longhand allows me to actually imagine the spaces, the city that I'm going to spend some time in, the city of my story. And there's a lot of tinkering and changing the smallest things in sentences and even phrases, including counting beats if necessary, moving, you know, commas and dealing with punctuation, all these things. Very, very tiny operations. And then it's still not done. I mean, what I'm going to read now, I don't think it's done. But when it is going to be done, I do not know. I will hope soon. In any case, the story is about a Bosnian poet who the narrator used to know before the war. And because they used to go to the same place and hang out with other poets, much less significant. And then when the war began, the narrator, much like me, leaves Bosnia and comes to the United States. And this poet stays in Sarajevo and writes under siege. So the narrator meets the translator of this poets. He's known as Dedo, which means old man in Bosnian. The narrator meets the translator of Dedo's poetry in Madison, Wisconsin, and gets drunk with him. And so the following morning, he remembers the story that the translator told him about Dedo. So this is what I'm going to read. It was while I was slouching down the linden-lined street, people nodding at me from the sunny porches, healthy-looking squirrels racing up and down the trees, birds a-twitter. It was then that the story Bill had told me about Dedo the night before fully hit me, and I had to sit down on the curb to deal with it. Dedo came to Iowa City straight from the besieged Sarajevo, Bill said, to be in the International Writers Program for 10 weeks. Bill had arranged it all and volunteered to put up Dedo in the room above his garage. So Dedo arrives with a small duffel bag, emaciated and exhausted, with the English he picked up translating Yeats and a gallon of Johnny Walker he picked up in a duty-free shop. The first week he locks himself up above the garage and drinks without pause. Every day Bill knocks at the door, imploring him to come out, for they have to meet the dean and the faculty. They have to do the mingling. Dedo refuses to open the door, let alone mingle, and finally stops responding altogether. Bill and Melissa, his wife, are worried. They deliberate before the door. Melissa tries to call him, and Dedo recites a poem to her in English through the closed door. Or at least she thinks it is in English, and it is a poem, for it is garbled by the pronunciation and the inebriation. Finally, Bill breaks the door, and the room is an unreal mess. Dedo has not slept in the bed at all, and the bed is inexplicably wet. There are monstrous bloody footprints everywhere because Dedo broke the Johnny Walker bottle and apparently walked all over it. A box of cookies is torn open and the cookies are crumbled but not eaten. In the trash can, there are dozens of Podravka pate cans, cleaned out and then filled up with cigarette butts. And Dedo is sleeping on the floor in the corner farthest from the window, facing the wall. They subjected him to repeated cold showers. They cleaned him up and aired the room. They practically force-fed him. For another week, he wouldn't stick his nose out of the room, and Bill and Melissa would go to his room and talk to him, not really sure how much of it was reaching Dedo, for he seldom said anything. And then Bill said he did not sleep for a week, writing as if possessed, delivering poems first thing in the morning, demanding translations by the afternoon. American poets used to be like that, Bill said wistfully. Now all they do is teach and complain and sleep with their students on the sly. Bill canceled his classes and set out to translate Dedo's fresh poems, and it was like entering the eye of the storm every day. In one poem, Bill said, a bee lands on a sniper's hand because he ate honey with his fingers that morning, and he waits for the bee to sting him. In another one, Dedo sees an orange for the first time after the siege began, and he's not sure what is inside, if oranges changed while he was away from the world, but then he finally peels it, and the smell inhales him. Dedo is running down Sniper's Alley, and a woman is telling him that his shoe is untied, and with the perfect clarity of purpose, with the ultimate respect for death, he stoops to tie it, and the shooting ceases, for even the killers appreciate an orderly world. I could not believe, Bill said, that such things could come out of that pandemonium. At the end of the third week, Dedo had a reading, all brand new poems. He had a mug of Johnny Walker at hand, and he barked and hissed his verses at the audience, pointing at them with his shaky finger. They were taken aback, for they could not understand, why he was so angry at them. Bill would come out after Dedo and read the translations in his deep Viking voice, slowly and serenely, the way the audience was used to, but that didn't help. They politely clapped, but they were insulted. Faculty and students came up to Dedo afterwards to ask him about Bosnia and invite him to luncheons. He visibly loaded them, livening up only when he saw a prospect of laying one of the graduate students willing to open her mind to other cultures. He was gone next week, straight back to be under siege, sick of America after less than a month.
New work from Alexander Heyman. Probably will be reading it in, the New Yorker sometime?
Yeah, I hope so.
This is a good time for anybody who has some questions for Sasha to come down to one of the two microphones here. We will have time for a couple questions. And there are a lot I haven't asked, which I'm sure any number of you could ask instead. So don't be shy. Come down. Stand in front of them. One question I guess I have is, what does happen to a story like this? Do you send it out when you're done with it? Or are people commissioning you for these? Or at this point, now that you're a MacArthur Fellow?
Well, MacArthur Fellowship does not guarantee publishing your stories. But I do have an arrangement of a sort with the New Yorker in which they have the first read rights. That is, if I write a story or whatever else, in fact, I have to show it to them. So if it is possible, it might appear in The New Yorker. But I show it, depends on the story, I show it to people I like and love, so I can imagine how they see that, how they see the story, and in this imaginary reading situation, before they even tell me anything, I make a lot of decisions. And then on top of that, they give me their suggestions.
Have they ever actually turned you down, a story?
Who?
New Yorker.
Yeah, one before this arrangement, yes.
Okay.
That's
checking.
Why we have the arrangement.
We have some questions. Thank you.
Very much enjoyed your reading, and
I think it's okay if you just leave it there. Yeah, it's
okay.
Great.
I'm amazed at your mastery of English.
Thank you.
I had two questions. A, reading any storybook poem in its original language versus a translation, and how do you feel that the local audience receives your writings, given that they are written about other places in the world, other histories in the world?
Thank you. Well, you know, Robert Frost said that poetry is what is lost in translation, and that is to a large extent true. On the other hand, it is hard to know what a poem or a book can gain in translation. There's this, because no matter how you take it, the languages are not really separated from one another. There's an overlapping area. And they're also not separated in a sense that every language is a part of a human body that speaks it. So despite the difference in the structural characteristics of a language, everybody approaches language the same way, regardless of what your native language might be. So to me, it is interesting what happens in translation in so many ways. But in order not to lose the poetry of translation, I write in English, write fiction in English, but I write in my native language too. Ideally, you know, this is an impossibility, obviously. I would like to speak all of the languages of the world and write in all of them, and at least many of them. Unfortunately, it's only two right now. So translation is something that is not to be shunned. And the translation situation, by the way, in this country is catastrophic. Less than 3%, and this is on good years, of books, that is, literary books, if you wish, published in this country are translations. Many of them, the so-called classics or, you know, Nobel Prize winners. But if you want to know what people are writing in Poland, you would be hard-pressed to find a book translated from Polish, or not to mention Bosnian, as some smaller, you know, nation, Lithuania, or Africa, for that matter, any of the African languages. I shudder to think how few African languages books are published in this country. What was the other question? I'm sorry.
We have a bunch of people lined up here, so maybe okay. We'll try and move it along a little
All
bit.
Right.
Yes.
I was fascinated when you said that when a refugee or an immigrant comes to this country, you abandon what you were and become what you are now. Don't you feel that you retain some of what you were, that again, it may not just be a linear line but an offshoot? Do you completely change?
You retain it, but what I have retained you cannot see right now, because, you know, what you see is the American me, as it were. It's not that you lose everything in the absolute sense. I mean, then it's not that your memory is erased. It is that your life has at least two sides or two aspects, and there are few people, if any, who can see both of those or all of those aspects. And so the Cubist painting, you know, comparison comes in handy here, because what you can see is only part of me. That is ultimately the case with everyone's life, but you fit yourself into the narrative that you share with other people. What is it to be American? What is it to live in Chicago? You know, that's undeniably yours, I mean, as Americans. But I only have partial access to that, which is okay. But this is the only part of me that you can really see.
You have a question. Thanks.
Okay. I just wanted to say that Nowhere Man really blew me away. It's one of my newest inspirations. I write, too, and there's that
Thank
extra
you.
Layer in it that I've spent a lot of time in Bosnia, and I'm married to a man from Zenica. And sometimes I share with him little things from the book that I think are funny, like Mr. Smrdi Prdiunkas from Greenpeace and stuff like that, which is
nice
a joke you get if you speak the language. My husband doesn't speak English, and I want so much to share the book with him. So the question I thought was, have you ever thought of, or have people offered to a deal to translate it back into your language, and what would you feel about that?
Well, the there are translations in the former Yugoslav languages, in Croatian and Serbian, and there's one in Bosnian too, so they should be available. And I have translated some parts of it, and not very successfully, the first book, because an author should not translate himself or herself. But there are books available. They might be hard to find, as things from Bosnia, those parts are hard to find in general, but they're there.
Okay,
thank you.
Another question.
Thank you so much for sharing with us. It was just a real pleasure to listen to you. And I wondered, were you a published author in Bosnia, or were you a student, or just what exactly did you do before you came to America?
I was professionally young. I was a young journalist, and I also wrote for publications and a radio show that was, you know, geared toward young people. And so, including a column for a magazine that was much closer to literature than any sort of journalistic work.
Aren't you still writing for them, for Danny?
Yeah.
Heyman
yeah,
Wood
yes,
is the name of
yes,
your column?
I do. That's
Sorry
what
to
I write
embarrass
in my native
you.
Language. That's okay. But I had, I think, one or two stories published in my native language before I got here. And I've written a few, too, but they were awful. So I'm glad that more were not published.
I am so glad that I got to see you to hear you because
exist, yeah.
Yes. And I'm so happy that you exist.
So am I.
because you are the voice of my own soul. I am an immigrant to this
Thank
country
you.
And I struggle with this dilemma of not being who I seem to be and not many times not being able to reach out and to make myself understood. And I'm also very concerned about my children, who I have four, who are born in this country and who seem to just give up their, or I would say my ideals, you know, because they just want to be common folks, which for them means, you know, just the images that they see on television and that's it. No, they don't aspire anymore. And when you read From the Dead, oh, I felt, my God, he's the image of, you know, the immigrant who just becomes bigger than his book and he just leaves. My question is, what supported you, besides being a compulsive reader, besides your natural talent, obviously, was there any, and I'm sorry, it's probably a personal question, is there any Christian aspect to this book, or are you an atheist, or is there any other support that you would recommend for a young person who's an immigrant to this country? What's the difference
Thank you.
Between immigrant and refugee?
You have like 30 seconds
30
to answer
seconds.
That. Thank
I'm,
you very
I'm,
much.
I'm
Great
not
question.
Religious. There's no Christian aspect. In my writing, I might be the only one in this country right now who's not religious. But I do believe in certain things, and I do believe in sort of inherent kindness of human beings, which then somehow, somewhere along the way, gets violated. And it is from this kindness, which is a sort of a Chekhovian kindness. Oh, you can find it all over Chekhov, where I find my strength, that no matter what has happened in this world and in my life and in Bosnia and what is happening now in the United States, there are a lot of good human beings, and some of them read books, and that's my hope.
I know there are other people here who want to ask questions, which is great, and Sasha Heyman will be out in the lobby to sign books and answer questions for, I'm sure, as long as you are here to ask them, and it's probably wonderful to know that you've touched people in so many different ways, in so many different cultures, and I really want to thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much,
thank you.
Alexander. And thank all of you, too. Thank you for attending Writers on the Record with Victoria Laubman. I hope you tune in or come next month, February 20th, to hear Mark Kurlansky talk. Have a great, great rest of your day. Bye-bye.
A contributor to WTTW-11's Chicago Tonight and Art Beat, and also seen on CBS2's Eye on Chicago, Victoria Laubman, the host of Writers on the Record, has written articles for the Chicago Tribune, USA Today, The Reader, and the Chicago Sun-Times. She has been the Chicago editor for Metropolitan Home, Art and Auction, and Architectural Record, and has also contributed pieces to Interview, HG, El Decor, Architectural Digest, and many other magazines. To be in the audience for next month's live broadcast with author Mark Gorlansky, Sunday, February 20th at noon, from the Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks at 821 North Michigan, reserve a free ticket by phoning 312-832-6789. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Jacqueline Russell, General Manager David Schmitz, and Director of Production Lee Potter Murray, and to Chicago Magazine, including Editor Richard Babcock. Technical production was by Eric Arunas, the director was Carolyn Paulin, and the executive producer of Riders on the Record is Steve Robinson. This is WFMT Chicago, 98.7 FM, a service of Network Chicago, and in a moment, our Chicago Symphony Retrospective.